So good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us. We are here with the management team of William Hill US. Over the next 50 minutes or so, we'll be having a conversation regarding sports betting and the William Hill business, really focused on the US operations. With us is CEO Joe Asher and CFO Mark McMillan. Also on the line is head of William Hill's IR, Louise Turner-Smith. So let me just give you some quick background before we jump into Q&A. William Hill PLC is a leading betting company listed on the LSE, employing over 12,500 employees worldwide. Its U.S. business was established in 2012 in Nevada, where it is currently the largest sportsbook operator. William Hill U.S. continues to expand in the U.S. and is now active across several states as both an operator and a service provider. In New Jersey, William Hill operates at Monmouth Park Racetrack, Ocean Resorts Casino, Tropicana, Atlantic City, and also online. William Hill also is operating sports books in Indiana, West Virginia, and Iowa, a racebook in Florida, and an online operation in Iowa. William Hill is a licensed sports betting provider in numerous casinos in Mississippi and New Mexico, and serves as the exclusive risk manager for Delaware and Rhode Island sports lotteries. So with us is Joe Asher. Joe is CEO of William Hill US. He's been the CEO since 2012, has a very long background in the gaming industry, and has a lifelong passion for race and sports betting businesses. Prior to joining William Hill, Joe held management positions at several racetracks across the US, and previously was an attorney with Skadden Arps. Mark McMillan is the CFO of William Hill US. He's been with William Hill since 2011, originally joining the UK operation in corporate development and strategy before moving to Las Vegas in 2015 to take the CFO role. Also on the line with us is my senior associate, Kelsey, who many of you probably know. Kelsey's based in New York and has been running point on some of the sports betting and US gaming work that we've been doing. So if you have any direct questions for either of us, please feel free to reach out to us after this webinar. Finally, I just wanted to mention, most of you know, since you've been on these webinars before, that we use Pigeonhole to field any questions that you might have of the team. If you have any questions, please feel free to click on the link and pose the questions, and we'll try to get to them. So let me first turn it over to Joe. I think you wanted to have some intro comments, and then we can jump into questions. All right, Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks so much, and thanks everybody for joining us today. You know, I don't really have much to say from an opening statement other than I think a number of people are familiar with the William Hill U.S. business, and you just outlined a bit of it. You know, we've been at it now for 8 years here in the U.S. William Hill bought three small businesses that were based in Nevada, and that became the William Hill U.S. business. As currently, and when I say currently, I'm really talking about in a pre-COVID world. It's a little bit different now, obviously. But we operate about 113 retail sports books in Las Vegas, about 135 overall. But notwithstanding that, in Nevada, we do about 70% of our business on mobile, and in other states, even a little bit more. So the retail business is really there to support and help grow the mobile business. That's the way we look at it. We look at it as a great profit center in its own right, but also as a digital acquisition vehicle. So that's sort of the way we view the business. Obviously, I could go on and talk for quite a bit, but probably best if you guys ask the questions and then I'll try to answer.
Yeah, why don't we jump in with kind of some more big picture items, and then maybe we'll drill down on a couple of things. So maybe a big picture, obviously William Hill's involved. Obviously we're talking about the retail, which is the bricks and mortar business, and then the online operations. You also act as a service provider when you're not actually kind of the front of the house, you're doing more behind the scenes. Can you talk a little bit about your positioning kind of between online, the bricks and mortar business, and as a service provider, and which channel do you think has the most growth potential? You did mention earlier that you were really focused on online. But maybe you could kind of talk about all three of those segments. Maybe I'm missing something as well.
Yeah, well, look, obviously online is the growth of the business. And so that's not a big surprise. And the service provider model is really done in states where that's what's mandated by the regulation. So in Delaware, sports betting is run by the lottery, and we're a service provider to the lottery. It's the same in Rhode Island. In Mississippi, the way the licensing structure is set up, the casinos themselves are required to employ the folks who are actually taking the wagers, but they're using our technology, and we're the ones who are setting the odds and managing the risk on the back end. And so the service provider model is where it is mandated by legislation or regulation. And the retail businesses, look, they really run the gamut. I mean, you have some very small locations that are spread out across Nevada where we might not even have a live person working there. It's a kiosk-only model in some of the rural counties or smaller venues, to places where, you know, there might be one or two employees on the scene, and then all the way up to, you know, 10,000 square feet or more, and a full, you know, full-on audio-visual extravaganza. And so it really depends on what the circumstances are to define retail. And to some extent, I think we do it a disservice by referring to it as retail here in the U.S. It's really more experiential is the way that I think of it. I mean, if you go to the Ocean Resort in Atlantic City or the Tropicana or to a number of our sports books in Nevada, I mean, you know, these are really entertainment destinations. If you just want to make your bet, you know, that mobile serves as a great transactional vehicle. But you know, the retail or the experience is all about, you know, that communal environment. Now, obviously, that's very different now in the post-COVID world. But, you know, primarily, the retail experience is a place to socialize with your friend. But then we try to make it a place where we can get you to sign up for a mobile account so that you can bet, you know, not just when you're physically present in the sports book, but wherever you are during the week as well.
And Joe, just when we think about kind of the rollout of sports betting across the U.S., obviously everything is very state regulatory based, as you alluded to. Certain states allow online, certain don't, certain have to be a casino, others you don't. When you kind of think about what you guys have been doing first in Nevada and then since 2018, 2019, when the states began rolling out more sports betting operations, what are kind of your early learnings about the evolution of this industry in the U.S. and how it's different from what William Hill has been doing for decades in the U.K. and in Europe?
Well, the U.S. business, look, the fundamentals are the same, right? You're betting on a game. But certainly it's very different. And you know, the way I tend to look at it is really focusing on the Nevada business, not so much, you know, the UK business, because, you know, they're pretty different businesses in various countries. But clearly what you're seeing in the US, I think, is as states move to legalize sports betting, you know, the embrace of it from the sports leagues and the media companies has been something that I think is going to greatly accelerate the rollout of the business. And then, of course, you have just the general consumer reaction, which has been very encouraging for sure. And I think, obviously, coming out of COVID, when you look at the state budget deficits that are going to be have to be dealt with, you know, one of the options for raising revenue for states clearly will be legalizing sports betting. I think that's more likely to happen in states where, you know, the legislation has already been pending, and so it's not a completely new topic. I think that, you know, those are the states that will move forward sooner rather than later coming out of COVID. And then, of course, you know, the other piece to this is we see the competitive landscape early on, and you know, also we have to recognize that that's going to continue to evolve over time as well.
So on just the COVID, I want to touch on it, and then I want to move off of COVID and kind of focus longer term. You mentioned that some of the states may move a little bit faster on legalization or bringing sports betting to the forefront, especially those that have been in process over the past 6 months or 12 months. Do you see more states going down the path of online, or is COVID not really going to trigger this?
Oh, no, I think, look, I think we all know the future of the business is online, right? And you know, some states will legalize retail to start, and then they'll have some sort of a mobile offer. But as I say, even in Nevada, where the retail business is so so substantial, we do 70% of our business on mobile, and that's in a market which clearly has the biggest retail presence of them all. So I don't think there's any doubt that the future of the business is online. And you know, to some extent, I analogize it a little bit to commercial banking in the way that I think about it. You know, when my wife and I moved to Las Vegas from New York back in 2006, you know, in New York, we had our bank accounts with Chase, move out to Las Vegas, and we opened up an account with Bank of America. You know, it was either Bank of America or Wells were convenient to us. We went with B of A. But you think about it today, and you do pretty much everything on your phone. Right, you deposit checks online, you transfer money between accounts online, you pay your bills online, but you know, you feel better when you see the retail branches that are out there, and then also if you have a question and you want to pop your head in to go in, you can. It's pretty rare that you actually go in. You do most everything on your phone, but the retail business is there to support the online business. That's sort of the way that we think about the business. That the retail business provides an opportunity for somebody to perhaps deposit money into their mobile account or withdraw money in cash out of their mobile account. They've got a question regarding it. They can pop their head in to the sports book to ask about it. And again, if they just want, you know, a different type of social experience, they can go into the sports book, but fundamentally, you know, the core transaction nature of the business is easiest to do online, and then you have in-play betting, which is you know, much more a mobile-driven product than a retail business, and we do have people betting in-play over the counter. But you know, for the vast majority of people, they're going to be, you know, sitting in front of the TV watching the game, oftentimes at home, and placing the bet on their phone.
Hi, Joe. So, talking about, sorry, go ahead, Vitaly.
Go ahead.
Oh, talking about the legalization of online gaming. Obviously, we see the future online, and post-COVID, there has been a lot more discussion around legalizing online gaming in different states. I was wondering, in your view, what might be some of the key hurdles at the state level to legalize online gaming?
Look, it's just a matter of policy priorities, I think, you know, fundamentally, and to where online gaming fits within the priorities of the legislatures in the various states, and then you know, what the other political dynamics around it are, and that just varies by state. You know, there's never been much of a move to have online gaming per se in Nevada outside of poker, and that's because of the vast retail footprint that you see for gambling here in Nevada. Obviously, it's been legalized in Jersey and Pennsylvania and coming soon in Michigan. And so, you know, clearly there'll be some other states in the future that do it, but I think it's fundamentally just about local priorities and where it fits within the existing gaming infrastructure.
And Joe, just maybe a big picture stepping back. When you guys look at the U.S. market, and I guess obviously a lot of this is dependent on who regulates, who allows, and what the structure of the actual market within the state is going to be. But when you think about the potential U.S. market, if you look at it from kind of an offline perspective, so in the retail business, and then you look at it online, how big do you think this market could actually be? It's a very difficult question, and it's going to be a broad range, but there's a raging debate about, you know, the scope and size of this market. You know, if you look 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, what the potential actually is. How are you guys thinking about this?
Well, I think as a general rule, we see the various estimates that are put out there by various analysts, and you know, they do span the spectrum. I think at one point the 5 year expectation was around somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 billion in GGR, and now folks expect that to go higher. Obviously, tough to predict because you don't know the pace of legislation. And when it's going to happen, and what the, you know, what the political dynamics are in those various states, because they oftentimes differ. But you know, fundamentally, it's obviously a pretty substantial market. Clearly, the market is viewing it as a very substantial market when you look at the valuations that are out there today, either in the direct public companies or the ones where there's an indirect opportunity. So, you know, whether it's 10, 20 billion, 30 billion, whatever the number is and over what period of time, I think is something that experts can debate, but clearly it's a pretty large number.
And I guess when we think about kind of the potential of the market, we look at in-game betting, where I guess it's allowed in certain places, not allowed in other places. What is the potential for that market? Like, how important is it for in-game betting to actually occur in order to get a market size of the type that we've been talking about?
Oh, look, I think it's in-game's pretty important. It's very big in Europe, and it's a you know, a significant and growing percentage of the business here in the U.S. I think it's oftentimes misunderstood, right? In-game betting is really, at least in my mind, not about whether the next pitch is going to be a ball or a strike or a run or a pass, or whether Curry's going to make or miss a shot. You know, it's about who's going to win the game or a defined subset of the game. So what people are betting on in game is the outcome of the game, right? Who's going to win the game, total points scored, whether or not a team is going to cover a specific point spread. Or a defined subset of the game. So take, you know, Major League Baseball. There you can bet whether or not a team is going to score in the next inning, yes or no, or whether a run's going to be scored in the next inning, yes or no. And so you're taking a three-hour game and you're chopping it down into a 20 or a 30-minute game. And then you'll have people bet, you know, inning by inning in that regard, or quarter by quarter in a basketball game, or, you know, a popular bet in hockey is total goals scored in the first period, for instance. And so, you know, fundamentally, that's the biggest aspect of in-play. You know, will it go to some of the really granular stuff? I think, you know, that's to be determined. And then how granular does it get, right? Is it batter by batter in baseball as opposed to, you know, on the next pitch, right? Those are the questions, I think, to be answered. But, you know, fundamentally, it's a bet on the outcome of the game, even though it's placed after the game has already started.
And so in play, when you have in-play betting, do you get a higher yield or higher betting amount by the player? Or is it more players come in who are more interested in that type of betting? How does it actually play out?
I think it's inherently a lower margin product in play. But the, you know, the amount bet, you know, is really all over the place. I mean, you know, you'll have guys betting, you know, $1,000 or more per inning in a baseball game. And then, you know, people betting $2, $5 on the next inning just to sort of have that rooting interest. So, you know, it really is all over the place. I think the, you know, on average, the bet size would be smaller in play than pre-match. But it's more about, you know, people making numerous bets during the game as the game evolves, and so oftentimes people will have, you know, more money bet during the game in smaller even though it's accumulated in smaller increments.
And let's just step back and think about kind of what are the problems I think some investors have when looking at this business, which is customer acquisition costs. And what their customer acquisition strategy is going to be. Are you just paying for revenue generation? If you look at some of the guys out there right now, the customer acquisition costs are so high that they're basically completely offsetting all current revenue. If you think about your strategy, how are you approaching the strategy of building out the business, especially in new states as they come online, while still being able to maintain a cost structure that makes sense?
Yeah, look, that's a great question. And obviously it's one where there's a lot of focus, right? Because you look at your CPAs, you look at what the lifetime value of the customers are, what you think the revenue, the ARPU per year is going to be from the various customers. And you know, clearly for us, I think that was probably the single driving motivator behind the deal we did with CBS Sports, was a way to more efficiently reach out to new customers, because CBS Sports has a large database of season-long fantasy players, and then also the millions of people who go to their digital products on a regular basis. And so clearly we made the decision that we could reach potential customers on a more cost-effective basis doing this deal with CBS, and we thought that the brands really aligned well also. And then the other area that I think, you know, we look to try to leverage is the player databases. And in particular, you know, once the Caesars Eldorado deal closes, the ability to leverage the Caesars database to help grow out that business is something that we think can be pretty attractive for us. But, you know, the fundamentals are all about, you know, what is it cost to acquire a customer, and then what's that customer worth to you, and trying to acquire customers in a cost-effective manner is really the heart of it, right? I mean, it doesn't do you a whole lot of good to spend $500 to acquire a customer who's only worth $200, right? So, you know, making sure that you're smart in how you're going about customer acquisition, I think, is essential and critical to the future of these businesses.
And so just on continuing on this discussion, if you look at some of your competitors, if you look at DraftKings or FanDuel with a large DFS database already in place, they already have a large potential embedded customer base as new states begin to open up. Right, that's a fair assessment. When you think about your business, not necessarily having that directly, but you are doing these partnerships, how important is the partnership model, right? Either being partnered with CBS Sports, being partnered with a casino operator, is there an ability to do it alone, or do you kind of have to have that model going forward?
Well, look, I mean, our model has fundamentally been built in partnerships. Whether it's, you know, casinos in which we operate or casinos in which we sign people up for mobile accounts, we've always viewed it as a partnership model. And in most of the states today, and probably going forward as well, the path to licensing flows through a partner, typically. I mean, I think, you know, for instance, Tennessee, where, you know, it's not going to be that model, but most of the states it is. And so partnerships are important, and they've been important to, you know, to our business from the start here in the US, and I think that's going to continue to be the case going forward. And you'll obviously, partnerships can mean various things depending on the nature of the deal and what exactly you're talking about, but they're pretty important, I think.
And so when you look at the DFS operators, let's just lump them into that category, with their kind of larger embedded database, and you look at your own operation, your competitive advantage vis-a-vis them is what? If you could kind of summarize kind of in one or two points. If you just look at those.
Yeah, I don't think about it that way. What's our advantage vis-a-vis somebody else in particular? So I wouldn't narrow it to, you know, to two companies. What I would say our overall competitive advantages are an expertise in operational execution and an expertise uh, in in the fundamentals of this business, and then the ability to leverage partnerships. I mean, I think we've proven we can do it pretty successfully here in Nevada, for a number of years. I mean, the Nevada business, broadly speaking, has been making about $45 million the last couple of years in EBIT, and that has funded the growth in the other states. And so we've proven that we can run a profitable business. I don't think anybody, I remember when the original board paper was done, when William Hill came to the U.S. and the fellow who did the board paper, I think he predicted that in a couple of years, the William Hill U.S. business would make something like $7 million. And I just thought that was crazy. I thought he was just, setting us up to fail. There's no way we're going to be able to make that amount of money in 2 years. And then, of course, we blew that away and have continued to grow the business. So I think proven, look, it's very easy to acquire customers if you're going to spend $1,000 to acquire a customer who's worth $500, right? That just doesn't do you very much good at the end of the day. So I think we focus on operational execution and how to develop and operate a profitable business, and then filling in the blanks where we need to. I think, the partnership model served us very well in Nevada the entire time. And, we've tried to be very focused and tactical on it going forward. When Iowa was getting ready to legalize sports betting, it was pretty clear that in order to sign up for a mobile account, you were going to have to register in person at a casino. And so we went and got a hold of the folks at Prairie Meadows in Des Moines, because that's the largest population center in the region. And so we did a deal with Prairie Meadows, and that's why we have the dominant share of mobile in Iowa. So the other big piece to this business, I think, in addition to partnerships, is clearly going to be around tech. And we're in the process of making a huge tech investment in this business. A number of people are using third-party tech companies, whether they be SB Tech or Canby or somebody else, and we've made the decision to try to do as much of it as we can. There's pluses and minuses to that approach, candidly, because it's a big investment. But on the flip side, we control it, we own it, and we get to decide what the priorities are going to be. And we know that that what we want done is always going to be at the top of the pile. In terms of priorities. So operational expertise and execution, leveraging partnerships, heavy investment in technology, and not only the casino partnerships, but as I say, the deal with CBS in particular, and the link out opportunities, and the ability to leverage that database that they have, and the eyeballs that they have, is something that we think is going to be pretty important to us. And all of these things cumulatively, obviously the idea is that they're going to lower our CPAs and give us a higher ARPU from those customers.
And if you thought about what you've been doing over the past couple of years, is there anything you would have done differently, moving in a different direction? Or do you think kind of you've executed to plan and that's kind of the progression that you've done, and it's worked out fairly well for you?
Yeah, the one thing that I would have done differently, and we're fixing it now, is we did not prioritize gaming as high as we should have. And so we're in the process of developing gaming and intend to launch gaming in New Jersey in the coming months. We just had prioritized other things previously rather than gaming. So that if I had one to do over, clearly that's the one I would do over. And it's more relevant, of course, during COVID with the limit on sporting events and then the corresponding uptick to gaming. Yeah. So the one thing that I would have done differently with the benefit of hindsight is prioritize gaming higher rather than some of the other things that we prioritize. But we're in the process of fixing that now.
And I guess kind of continuing on this kind of customer acquisition and business model approach discussion we're having. If you think about kind of the black market of sports betting in the U.S., right? I was in high school. We had a bookie. In college, we had a bookie. There's a very large embedded customer base that deals with bookies that they've known for years, sometimes for decades. How easy is it to convert those very avid players into kind of the new business model that's now more and more legal across the U.S.?
It depends. I mean, it's not simple by any stretch. I mean, I think you pointed out, right, in some of these situations, you have folks who have, multi-year or even decades long relationships with their bookies, and, you know, it's working fine for them. There's low motivation to change. I think, clearly some of them are changing, and you see that in particular in Jersey. I think you've seen a number of people move over from the black market. Obviously, it's much harder to do in a high tax jurisdiction like Pennsylvania, where, because the illegal bookmaker, I mean, he's paying zero in taxes and has zero compliance costs. And then, of course, the tax rate is so high for the legal operators, and then the infrastructure costs as well. But certainly for new players, you would think the vast majority of those would come in through the legal market, because it'll be an attractive acquisition offer for them, and they don't have that pre-existing relationship. So certainly with the vast, and the big opportunity in the business fundamentally will be introducing new players and new customers into the ecosystem. They're the easiest to get in because they don't have that pre-existing relationship. But then it's a matter of offering a better product, a more convenient product for customers. And look, they also have the safety and security from a regulated product that you don't have in the illegal market, right? You don't have to worry about whether or not, your bookie is going to get busted by the police, or whether he's got a drug problem or he's gambling himself. All those things that you worry about in the illegal market are just not concerns at all in the legal market. So I think over time, you start to winnow away more and more and more at the black market, but it doesn't, completely go away. At least during a time that's relevant to me anyway.
Right. And you said, tax is one of the key maybe impediments to getting out of that. We see that in the marijuana business, where even though you've legalized marijuana across numerous states, you have taxation, which leads to higher pricing relative to the black market. You have the same thing going on in gaming. If you think about just more broadly about the tax structure across states, the shift to more mobile, more online, is that going to give pressure on the tax front? Are states just going to start raising taxes because they see once you acquire the customers, once the costs come down, the profitability begins to rapidly rise? Do we get kind of the regulatory danger of an increasing tax hike across the board, in particular on online where costs could be more managed?
Yeah, look, it's great. It's a great question, I think it's something that clearly you have to be forever vigilant around. Thus far, Pennsylvania has really been the major outlier from a taxation standpoint. Illinois higher tax rate than others. Tennessee, relatively high tax rate, but you don't have the path to licenses through existing casinos. So for a pure sports betting company, it doesn't ultimately become necessarily a higher tax rate. But by and large, most of the states have come in, sort of plus or minus 10%, and in an area that encourages investment. And I think the key thing is really going to be around the messaging and making it clear and understood by policymakers that, you know, yes, you have the gaming tax, but it's important to look at all other aspects of the sports betting ecosystem, right? You want to look at jobs created. What are the payroll taxes that flow from that, right? What are the other taxes that are generated and economic activity that is generated by this particular business? So I think it's something clearly that folks will have to maintain vigilance around for sure as we move forward. But thus far, it's been encouraging, and that's why you see the investment that you do in the industry today.
Joe, when we talk about kind of the differences between online and retail, obviously there's a lot of cross traffic between these two. I was wondering, what are your thoughts on the competitive dynamic differences between running online and retail operations?
Yeah, I just view them as we were talking about earlier, Kelsey, as complementary businesses. And for us anyway, retail being a great way to acquire mobile customers because, you know, people come in, they sign up in a casino for mobile because they enjoy the experience and they want to be able to bet more. So I view them as fundamentally complementary. And as I say, they're fundamentally different experiences, right? If all you want to do is get down a particular bet on a game, you know what you want to bet, where it's fairly, you know, straightforward bet, just pure transactional aspect, very easy to do on mobile. But there's clearly a different experience that you get in the retail environment. You know, if you look at other companies, I mentioned commercial banking earlier and how that's evolved into, you know, the bank branches are largely customer service centers to help customers who are doing most of their transacting online. I think Starbucks just does a phenomenal job with their mobile app and the retail experience versus ordering on mobile or going to the drive-thru. I think the way to look at these businesses are as complementary businesses. And I think if you take the approach that, you know, you just want to do one or the other, you know, you miss the opportunity that can flow from having both of them.
Right. What about the profitability differentials between these two parts of the businesses?
Yeah. Historically, we've always gotten a much quicker return from retail investment. You know, we've always tried to be very disciplined in our investment. We just as you would in any business, right? You model out what you think the business volumes are going to be, what your expense pace is going to be, and what's the return on your investment. And so we've always been pretty disciplined around retail investment. And similarly, it's, you know, there's investment to be made on the digital side. It's just different things, right? Because it's all about, you know, the CPA and then what you think the revenue is going to be from that customer and your ability to get existing customers to engage more with the product and to spend more. But you've got to do so, obviously, in a responsible fashion. So, in both channels, I think the tenet has always got to be around disciplined investment and making sure that you're comfortable that the return you're going to have is going to be something that justifies the investment that you've made.
Right. If we switch gears to profitability questions for a little bit, Joe. I know in Nevada, we have generally lower marketing efforts than some of the other regional states and higher, and hence we have higher profit margins. But in states like New Jersey, the market is a lot more competitive. And I believe our margins there are probably not comparable to Nevada. I, I was wondering, so as we continue to roll out in the rest of the US, where do you kind of see profitability settling for the industry and for William Hill?
Yeah, look, that's the great question. That's a great question. And the marketing expense that you see in New Jersey has obviously made it tough for folks to make money in New Jersey. And, you know, to some extent, I analogize it a little bit to like, you know, Iowa was for Democratic presidential candidates over the last 12 months, where you had, you know, 20 some folks, you know, come to Iowa because they wanted to be president. And then, you know, the field got winnowed down after Iowa, and then after New Hampshire and Nevada, winnowed down a little bit. And then, of course, I really winnowed down quite a bit after South Carolina. And so, you know, right now you're seeing a lot of folks who have aspirations of being in the sports betting business in America, you know, look to New Jersey and invest in that market. I think in other states it varies. It varies by the dynamic, you know, what's the licensing structure in those states, and you know, then what's the population and what do you think you're going to be able to make in those states. I think, you know, for us, and clearly this is something that was important to us in doing the deal with Eldorado originally, and one of the big benefits to the Caesars deal is going to be the guaranteed market access in a whole host of states on economics that, you know, that we're comfortable with. And some states will just be more competitive than others. And I think, you know, that's going to be, you know, that's going to be the case. And whether that's driven by population, taxes, number of licenses available, and then just the demographics of that particular state, I think is what's going to drive it. Also, I think you're going to see a scenario where you'll have folks who focus on, you know, a small number of states and try to do particularly well in those states, for instance, rather than focusing more broadly. And then over time, you'll see consolidation in the industry. And I think, you know, it may flow from that, right? Somebody who's done a really good job of building up a business in one or two or three states ultimately becomes a seller to somebody who has more national aspirations. But I think, you know, we're a little ways away from the consolidation phase, but I don't think there's any doubt that it'll eventually come.
Right. Joe, you mentioned how different states have different taxation, different fees, and that might change the economics of running a sports book in the regional US market. And I was wondering if there's any state in here that you just find fundamentally unprofitable to operate in.
I think there's some states where you just, I wouldn't single out a particular state other than to say, obviously, look, New Jersey is one where there's been such massive investment that I don't think any of the operators are you know, necessarily happy with the early return is, but that doesn't mean that's not going to change ultimately. But I think, you know, again, it's going to come down to those core fundamentals, and you're certainly going to invest less and deprioritize states where you don't think there's enough investment, whether you don't think there's enough revenue to justify the investment.
Right. Are there any mitigants operators can use to offset tax leakage? Or is this kind of just we're accepting it's a price of doing business in that particular state?
Are there any what that operators
mitigants? Are there any other, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, again, that, it's at the margins. At the margins is what I'd say. I think fundamentally it's going to be where do you focus your resources, especially as states roll out. And there's no limit to the number of things to be done, I mean, the number of tech projects, for instance, that we've got underway in the company is significant. And, you know, where are you going to focus your energies and how you're going to prioritize the opportunities is going to be driven by what you think the return on those is going to be. And clearly, you know, one of the big aspects of the expense base will be taxation.
Right. And Joe, I know we have both kind of B2B and B2C services in different states. How do we think about the margin differential there? And over the long term, I'm assuming that you prefer to be more exposed in the B2C category because you get to own the customer. Is that how we should think about it?
Yeah, I look, you know, yes. I mean, I think it's clearly, we operate both in the B2B and B2C worlds, right? Because the partnerships are so fundamentally important to the business, and we put a lot of efforts into those partnerships, you know, joint marketing initiatives, how do we drive business into their casinos, you know, how do we make their business better is important. And then at the end of the day, we're also, you know, we're transacting in most of the states, right, directly with the end users, right? Put aside the, you know, the markets where we're a service provider, whether it's, you know, Rhode Island, Delaware, or Mississippi. In the vast majority of circumstances, we're dealing with the customer directly. So I've always thought of our business as one where we have to do well at both the B2B and B2C level.
Right. Any thoughts around the profitability between these two segments?
Well, I don't view them as separate, as different profits, if you will. You know, fundamentally, obviously there's payments that we pay to our partners, whether they be casino operators or whether they be CBS, for instance. And so most of the time, the B2B aspect of the business is an expense, but it's an expense that's very important for us in driving revenue. So I don't look at them as sort of separate profit centers. You know, the service provider model is, you know, is a fairly small percentage of the overall business.
Gotcha. Switching gears a little bit. So I want to go back to kind of, you know, COVID brought a temporary stop to sports seasons, but not esports. And this is kind of one of the emerging areas that people like to talk about among sports betting. I was wondering, where do you kind of see esports betting market could be in the next 5 to 10 years? And what are some of the key catalysts or ingredients that need to happen for the market to get there?
Yeah, look, historically, esports has gotten a lot of attention in terms of what does it mean for betting, and far more attention than the actual betting dollars, right? So far more attention from the media than from consumers as a betting product. But I think that it's clearly starting to grow during the COVID world. How much of a betting opportunity it ultimately becomes, I think, is very much unclear. And of course, once the major sports come back, then the attention that's spent on esports probably decreases. Esports is a separate standalone business I'm a huge believer in. Right, I'm a total believer in people watching esports, competing in esports, and esports as a separate, independent business. How much of a betting opportunity it becomes, and how much of an opportunity it is for betting companies, I think is very much still to be determined.
Right. Maybe just one last question from me. I was wondering if you have any concerns around potential advertising restrictions in the U.S. Because as you know, in Germany, sportsbook can advertise on TV and online, but cannot advertise during a live sports broadcast. in Italy, there's almost a wide-scale ban on all forms of gambling advertising. I was wondering, what's your view on the potential restrictions in the U.S.?
Yeah, it's such a great question, and I think it's ultimately going to be it's incumbent upon the operators to be responsible in terms of advertising, or you will over time see restrictions. Now, obviously, so much advertising is done digitally these days, as opposed to on network television or on cable television. I think it's unlikely that you'd get back to the backlash you saw around the daily fantasy sports betting companies a few years ago, when it was so annoying to turn on your television at the start of the NFL football season, whatever, 2015, 2016. I don't see it going to that extent because of the ability to reach customers so effectively and efficiently in a digital fashion. If there is an excessive amount of advertising that's done, then I think over time you will see people get fed up, get sick with it, and you'll see a regulatory backlash to it. So I think it remains to be determined. I think it's very important for the industry to be responsible about it. We try to put a big focus around for any sort of television advertising we're doing, so both the content and the frequency is something that we try to be very careful about to avoid the scenario where there's a regulatory backlash. But as I say, I think the ability to reach customers so effectively by other channels lessens the immediate likelihood of a advertising ban or substantial advertising restriction.
And Joe, similarly on that, let me just jump in because we're going to run out of time in a few minutes. I want to get to two more things. Just on that kind of corporate social responsibility angle, in the UK, in some other jurisdictions, we've been seeing a lot of pressure on limiting bet sizes, right? Limiting the amount of spend per customer. We haven't really seen any of that in the U.S., even in the casino world. Is that a concern that you have at all? Or is that something that, as you say, if the operators are smart and responsible themselves, we're not going to get into that problem?
I think it's something that's always a concern, and it's important. It's just not particularly easy, right? I mean, one customer can afford to bet a lot more than another customer can afford to bet. So, sort of a blanket, restriction on, the amount that a customer can bet or the amount that a customer can lose. I just don't know how you sensibly go about it, right? It just becomes too arbitrary. What I think, does become important are things like, the ability for customers to put deposit limits on their accounts and things like that, I think are important. And then I think, over time, hopefully as a whole, the industry will get better and better and better at identifying scenarios where there's problem gambling and how you can then reach out to customers. It's something we spend a great deal of time thinking about and working in our business, and I'm sure others do as well. So there's a cultural aspect to it as well, in terms of what Americans expect their government to do, or what Americans are willing to allow their government to do, is quite different than it might be in other countries. Clearly there's a focus on self-responsibility in the U.S., perhaps more so than you see in other countries. And that doesn't necessarily serve us well during the time of the coronavirus, when you see, folks, not wanting to wear a mask, for instance, when they go out in public. So I think there's just cultural differences that are at play as well. But, and this ties into the point, as you say, around advertising as well. But, you know, the need to just be aware and alert and responsible, you know, I think is pretty significant, because when you have a product that's largely been an illegal product, now you're making it a legal product, it's obviously you're going to see more people being exposed to it, and a small percentage of people will have a problem with it. But you still have, you know, the fact that it's 1 or 2%, whatever it is, doesn't mean you don't have a problem. It means you better figure out what you're going to do, you know, for 1%, so it doesn't become a big problem that's fundamental to the business.
Okay, that's helpful. We're almost out of time. I had one follow-up question. I just want to make sure I heard you correctly. Very early, we were talking about in-play betting, and I think you said that the margin on in-play could be lower than straight betting. Was that correct? And if so, why is that the case? Because I think there's a perception out there from some people we've talked to, and I think some of the other analysts out there that have said that it'll be a higher margin business. Maybe elaborate a little bit.
Yeah, and there are two aspects of margin in this business, and we go back and forth on them internally, but because we understand them, folks externally may not. There's margin in terms of what's the hold percentage on a particular wager, right? Customer bets $100, how much does the sports book retain? Okay, that's the margin on the bet. The win, the hold percentage, whatever you want to call it. Broadly speaking, in Nevada, 4.5% to 5%. We've always outperformed that. So, customer bets $100, sportsbook wins $5. That's margin. Okay, but then there's your operating margin as well, right? Where you say, okay, we've got this amount of revenue, this amount of expenses. Our operating margin is 30%. Okay, so. What I was talking about earlier is that for the first aspect of margin, which is trading margin, where on an in-play betting, broadly speaking, we hold a little less in-play than we do in pre-match betting. Pre-match betting includes a lot more parlays, which are higher margin products inherently, right? Parlays generally could have a 20% or higher margin. Balanced against straight bets, where the theoretical margin at least is 4.55%, all balances out, you know, for us somewhere in the 6 to 7% range in Nevada, for instance, right? Overall market, you know, 4.5 to 5. And so in play, fewer parlays, more binary types of wagers, therefore lower theoretical margin, lower actual margin. That's different from the profit margin at the end of the day.
Okay, just clear. One comment. I mean, I've not spoken the whole time. When you think if the analyst from the customer perspective, in-play betting is another opportunity to wager. And so from a player value perspective, it's something they may do in addition to the pre-match bet they made. And therefore, the ultimate revenue the book holds may grow. That makes sense. So from a
That makes sense. Okay. All right, good. I think it's 12 o'clock. So I think we're out of time. I had more questions, but maybe we'll get to them again next time. I want to thank both of you guys for joining. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I hope this has been helpful for the people listening. I hope it's been helpful for you guys. We'll be sure to follow up. Anything else you guys want to close off with, or are we good?
No, we're good. Thanks for your time.
All right. Thanks a lot. We appreciate it. Take care.